All right, we're going to go ahead and get started. We're grateful that you're here. Reza Aslan is an Iranian-American author, commentator, religious scholar. He has written two books on religion, Not God, But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam, and Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. We are so grateful that you're able to join us via Skype. Technology is pretty awesome. So what we're going to have you do is just go ahead and speak to us for about 10 minutes, give us some thoughts, and then we'll go ahead and move into about a 20-minute question and answer period. So, and I'll repeat the questions that the audience asks. So take it away, sir.
Great. Thank you so much. Hi, everyone. It's such a pleasure to be able to join you from Los Angeles. When I was first approached by Lindsay to speak to this conference, I really wanted to do it because for me, so many of the issues that this community is dealing with are issues that are familiar, which is, identity, orthodoxy, heterodoxy. What does it mean to actually adhere to a certain doctrine, a certain ideas, and yet to have a kind of identity that questions some of those parameters, that seeks to reinterpret issues, doctrines, theologies that are in many ways, set in stone. I think these are issues that not just the Mormon community, of course, in the U.S. is dealing with. Certainly the Muslim community is dealing with it. But it is, I think, a part of what it means to be a faithful religious person in the modern world. As a teacher, I think it's always important for me to begin by defining terms. And I think terms like fundamentalism and orthodoxy and then, of course, heterodoxy are problematic for a lot of reasons, primarily because when we use terms like orthodoxy, correct belief, what we are saying, what we are assuming is that there is such a thing that in any faith, in any tradition, regardless of what tradition we're talking about, that there are a set of principles that one can sort of unanimously agree upon, a particular interpretation that all members of this faith community agree is quote unquote correct. And that's simply not true. That's simply not the case. Religion, whatever else religion is predicated on interpretation. And then by definition, every interpretation is a valid interpretation. Now, that doesn't mean that every interpretation is equally reasonable, equally justified, that every interpretation has the same weight, whether it's, historically contingent or whether it's scripturally contingent. But it does mean that when we use terms like orthodoxy, what we are sort of agreeing upon is this false assumption that there is a set of ideas that is static, that is quote unquote fundamental, that is universally acknowledged. And so therefore, anyone who disagrees with those ideas in any form, in any degree, is now heterodox. And so by definition is outside of the community. That's not how faith works. It's not how faith works in practice. It's not even how faith works in theory, to be honest with you. I find that people who do hold fast to these notions of orthodoxy tend to think what they mean by orthodoxy, in other words, is what they think it is. And so we need to have a larger conversation about whether such a term, orthodoxy or orthopraxy, is even a valid term when it comes to contemporary expressions of religious faith. The other term, of course, is fundamentalism. This too is quite a problematic term. Most of you are familiar with this term arose. It's a distinctly American religious phenomenon, a Protestant American religious phenomenon, one that arose at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, primarily as a reaction to the scientific progress, the scientific methods and a reaction primarily to the Christian liberalism that came out of the scientific process. This notion that scripture, for instance, should be read in figurative terms, that historical context should be involved in hermeneutics or in exegesis, that what we refer to as scripture, as divine as that scripture may be, is nevertheless privy to literary influences, cultural influences, etc., etc. Well, a number of conservative, mainly Protestant Christians in the United States reacted against those trends within Christianity by reverting to what they referred to as the fundamentals of their faith, hence where we get the term fundamentalism. Chief among those fundamentals, of course, was a relatively new notion, this idea of scriptural inerrancy and scriptural literalism, that what we read is literally true. Now, I want to explain that part of that notion and why it is new is because the definition of true that was being used by these Christians was a new definition. For much of religious history, true did not mean fact. These were different words. What was true in a scripture or in a mythology was not necessarily, it did not necessarily entail the facts of scripture or of that mythology, but an underlying truth that was much deeper than what we would refer to as, simple facts. And yet, because the scientific revolution brought up a new definition of true, that which is true is that which can be factually verified, for a number of these conservative Christians, it became very important to express scripture as though it is something that can be factually verified, and hence the term fundamentalism. Now, obviously, in our modern parlance, fundamentalism has come to mean completely different things. It's come to become synonymous with religious conservatism, for instance, which I think is somewhat problematic. It's come to be synonymous with religious violence, which, of course, is a completely different issue. And I think that's another thing that we need to talk about. Let's not just question what we mean by orthodoxy, but let's question what we mean when we use the term fundamentalism. Is it necessarily a good or bad thing to have particularly conservative interpretations of a scripture? When we, as progressive people of faith, denigrate those literalist or conservative interpretations, are we not committing the same sin that the fundamentalists commit when they denigrate progressive or liberal interpretations of faith? What does it mean to be a believer? Who is us and who is them? These are all questions that, unfortunately, don't have very easy answers. But I think what's important and why I wanted to be a part of this conversation is that the simple act of asking these questions is in and of itself enough. It is in and of itself enough to actually build the kind of diverse faith communities, regardless of what faith we're talking about, that I think have an opportunity to survive in what is a secularizing, modernizing world, a world in which faith is playing less and less of a role in the way that we define ourselves, both individually and collectively. So that's just where I want to begin, is by defining some terms, throwing out some ideas, and then hopefully that would be enough to start a nice conversation.
All right, we're going to unmute you just a second.
Yes, good.
Yes. All righty, we got to unmute you. Questions? Come on up to the front.
Hi, Reza. Thanks for doing this. This is really awesome that you're dialing in to the middle of Mormondom. It's cool. So with all the recent attention around fundamentalist Islam and the terrorism and that with Trump saying he won't let people in the country, with people like Bill Maher and Sam Harris, who I actually respect quite a lot, saying that the Quran itself and the religion itself has motivation for this violence. As I read your book, Zealot, it surely occurs that the core of Christianity also has these same kinds of threads. And so I just wanted to have you kind of talk about that more generally. Why is it that Christians tend to look at Islam as this fundamentally violent religion that spawns what we see today versus, you know, Christianity?
Well, I think that there's two very important aspects to your question. The first one is impression and where this impression of Islam comes from. We live in a country that is 71% Christian and barely 1%, less than 1% Muslim. And so the fact of the matter is that most Americans don't really have any kind of personal experience with Islam or with Muslims. What they know essentially is what they see on television, and what they see on television is news, and news is not, you know, predicated on nuanced conversations about the lived experience of faith, but about fear and terror, et cetera, et cetera. As you know, Nicholas Kristof once very, I think, astutely said, if the only thing that you knew, well, what he said was, the media is built to report on the plane that crashes, not the plane that lands safely. And so if the only thing that you knew about planes is what you saw in the media, you would just assume that every single plane crashed, because you were not ever seeing, you know, planes that land safely. We in the United States, when confronted with unapologetic acts of violence in the name of Christianity, for instance, when Robert Deere last year walked into a Planned Parenthood clinic and in the name of Christ killed four or five people, including an Iraq War veteran, the vast majority of Americans were able to separate that action from normative Christianity, because they live in a country in which 7 out of 10 people are Christian. And so it's very easy for them, whether they themselves are Christian or not, whether they themselves are familiar with Christianity or not, to tell the difference between normative expressions of Christianity and fringe expressions of Christianity, and to disconnect the two. However, when you live in a country in which 1% is Muslim, and the vast majority of Americans have no experience of Muslims, they have no knowledge of Islam, they don't have a normative example with which to compare extreme acts of violence in the name of Islam. And so it becomes very easy to just take those extreme examples and pretend that they are the norm, because you don't have an experience of the norm. I think that's where the impression is. By the way, let me just clarify that the same thing happens in reverse. When you go to Muslim-majority countries, for instance, Egypt, which is 96% Muslim, the same thing happens but with Christianity. When they are confronted on the news with acts of violence in the name of Christianity or in the name of Judaism, because they have no access to normative examples of Christianity or Judaism, they just assume that that's what Christianity and Judaism is, in the same way that we do with Islam. I want to talk about the first part of your question, however, which is the way in which this impression of Islam has become sort of dominated on the right and the left, whether it is, you know, Bill Maher or Donald Trump. You know, the one thing that they both agree on is this kind of knee-jerk hatred, this sort of bigotry towards Islam, a bigotry that comes, as I say, from, you know, complete lack of knowledge, a total ignorance of the lived expression of it. It's not that Islam doesn't have sort of aspects to it that can motivate violence. Of course it does. But it also has aspects to it that motivate peace and compassion. As I often say, the same Quran that says if you kill one individual, it is as though you've killed all of humanity, also says to slay the idolater wherever you find him. So if you focus on one of those verses and ignore the other, you're an ideologue. The same Torah that says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, also says, kill every man, woman, and child, every ox, goat, sheep that does not worship, that does not belong to Yahweh alone. If you focus on only one of those verses, doesn't matter which one, and ignore the other one, you're an ideologue. The same Jesus who said, turn the other cheek, and if you meet someone who doesn't have a cloak, give them yours, also said, I have not come to bring peace, but the sword. And if you do not have a sword, sell your cloak and buy one. If you focus on one of those verses and not the other one, again, it doesn't matter whether it's for peace or for violence, you're an ideologue. Bill Maher is an ideologue. Sam Harris is an ideologue. Donald Trump is an ideologue.
Hi, Reza. My name is Sarah Burlingame, and I was raised in the Baha'i faith, and I had a... Aloha, brother. I had an experience recently where I spoke at a vigil for Orlando, and I identified myself as someone who was born in the Baha'i faith, and I thought I said something really unobjectionable and maybe even like a little bit poetic. I said, I was born in the Baha'i faith. The Baha'i faith was born in Islam. And then I talked about, you know, what I knew of peace and gentleness in the world and how it came from a faith that came from Islam. And the next day, I received messages that the paper that had printed it had been picked up by the AP, and there was a group of very angry Baha'is who were agitating for the local paper to print a retraction, because the Baha'i faith did not come from Islam. It is an independent world religion. Who does the Sarah Burlingame think she is? And what a shoddy paper for printing such a thing. And it was so shocking to me to hear that level of I guess, ideologue-ness, particularly because I wanted to say, like, you guys know I know all the songs. I know all the stories. Like, it's the faith I was raised in. But it made me think of my friends in the Mormon faith and how sometimes that response when there just isn't any resiliency sometimes from leadership around how the faith is represented publicly. And when those hard questions come, because the reality is the Baha'i faith absolutely came out of Islam. And when those hard truths arise about Mormonism or about Islam, when the leadership responds with that, no, no, it's only one thing, it can only be one thing, and we won't entertain any questions, what is your best sort of practices around how we build that resiliency into the conversation and be able to say, like, oh, you guys know we're actually more than one thing, right?
Yeah. Well, so, you know, this issue with the Baha'i is one that I've dealt with a lot. Yes, it is essentially a sect of Shia Islam. But most Baha'i get very angry when you say something like that. Now, that, by the way, is a universal phenomenon. It is often the case that religions that are born from other religions, as they mature, part of the maturing process is to divorce itself from its parent religion. The best example of this, of course, is Christianity, which was a Jewish messianic movement, but which, as it matured and as it became larger, had to go out of its way to divorce itself from its parent religion as much as possible, to the point where essentially they stripped Jesus of his Jewishness. Same thing happened with Islam, by the way. Islam, which arose out of a Judeo-Christian religious tradition in which the Prophet Muhammad repeatedly said, this is not a new religion. This is the same religion that was revealed to Abraham and Moses and Isaac and Jesus. Their God is your God. Their scripture is your scripture. Very, you know, after the Prophet's death and when Islam began to expand and grow larger, they had to go out of their way to divorce themselves from their parent religion by demonizing their parent religion. And the same thing has happened with the Baha'i. Now, I will say in the case of the Baha'i, there's this one extra aspect to it, which is that the Baha'i are ruthlessly persecuted by the Shia in Iran. And so it's not just a matter of the maturation process that all religions go through where they deny their parentage. In this particular case, their parent is, you know, genocidal against them. And so they really do want to distance themselves as much as possible. But to your larger point, I think if you always remember this one adage, which is that religion, and it doesn't matter what religion you're talking about, it doesn't matter what part of the world you're talking about, religion is first and foremost a matter of identity. That certainly beliefs and practices are important. But when someone says, I am Muslim, I am Mormon, I am Baha'i, I am Jewish, they aren't just making a faith statement. They're making an identity statement. And as a statement of identity, it of course is wrapped up in all the other aspects of your identity. You are not just one thing. You are your faith and your nationality and your culture and your ethnicity and your gender and your sexual orientation and your politics and your socioeconomic position. All of these things make you who you are. And so all of them are going to have an effect on each other. And I think what happens is that when we confront people who say, you are not Baha'i because your Baha'i doesn't look like my Baha'i, or you're not Muslim because your Islam doesn't look like my Islam, or you're not Mormon because your Mormonism doesn't look like my Mormonism, what they are saying is not you don't accept a set of creeds or ideals or principles. What they are saying is you don't feel like I feel. And I think that we, particularly as progressives, have to be aware of that. We have to, dare I say, respect that and acknowledge it. But we can't give in to it. We can't say, oh, well, then I'm going to subsume my expression of my identity, including my faith identity, into your expression of it. Hence where I began this conversation, which is the problem with the term orthodoxy, because it assumes that there is some kind of static, monolithic, unchanging, and unanimous doctrine that everyone in a particular faith agrees with, and there isn't.
We're going to go ahead and take two more questions. Is that okay, Reza? Two more
sure.
questions?
Yeah, that's
great.
Maybe it's my TV, but I noticed that the Abrahamic religions seem to be very serious and have a history of defending their one true God in a way that the Buddhists, the Shintoists, and some others haven't, in my awareness. I'm sure there's more than what I'm aware of now. The other thing is, in the examples you gave of the person who went into a Planned Parenthood and did his shooting, there's a little bit of a difference between the organization and the community behind that act and the organization and community which seems to be behind Islamic fundamentalism.
Yes? Okay.
Yeah.
What was the first part? You said something at the very beginning that... Oh, yes, monotheism. And look, this is the problem of monotheism, is that it is monomythic. If you believe that there's only one God, very likely you believe that there's only one path to that God. I should say that while monotheism at this point is by far, you know, the most accepted form of deism, the most accepted form of theology, even in the religions of the East, it's also the newest form in the legitimately 150,000 year existence of something that could be deemed religion. Monotheism is barely 3,000 years old, and it took a very long time for it to actually catch on because of how problematic it is. That's a conversation for some other time. It seems as though in your question you imply that there is some kind of institutional backing for Islamic violence. And again, let's not use the term fundamentalism. That's a problematic term. You can be a fundamentalist and a great person. You can be a fundamentalist and peaceful. You can be a fundamentalist and we may decry your particular interpretation of religion, but as long as you keep it to yourself, who cares? So really, the dividing line in religion is not between fundamentalist and liberal or conservative and progressive. The dividing line is, do you use violence to promote your view or not? That's it, as far as I'm concerned. And it seems to me that what you're implying is that there is some kind of institutional backing for what is a very real problem of violence in the name of Islam. And what I would say is that I think you're misunderstanding not just where this violence comes from, but the purpose and the primary target of this violence. Whether you're talking about groups like Al-Qaeda or ISIS, you have to understand that these are deeply, profoundly anti-institutional movements. In many ways, they're reformist movements because their primary argument is not against the West. It's not against Christians or Jews. They have a term for them. They call them the far enemy. Their primary argument is against Islam and other Muslims. They are fundamentally puritanical groups. The thing about Puritanism is that it's inwardly focused. The primary goal of a Puritan is to purify his own religious community, to rid it of what the Puritan sees as its defilements, its innovations, which is why the victims, the Muslim victims of ISIS and Al-Qaeda and these sort of transnational jihadist organizations outnumber the non-Muslim victims by the tens of thousands. I mean, I understand that we only ever really pay attention when a non-Muslim gets killed by these guys. That's the only time that it ever actually piques our interest. But it is really about, I think, it's 4.4%? Isn't that? Yeah, so 4.4% of the victims of ISIS are non-Muslim. 4.4. So, you know, if you're talking about an organization in which 95-96% of its victims are other Muslims, then we have to stop and think about what that actually means for that organization. How are they defining themselves? How are they motivated? What these groups really are primarily preaching is that Islam has been corrupted by Muslim leaders, by Muslim clergy, by the Muslim institutions, by schools of law, by clerics, by mullahs. They are primarily preaching against the kind of normative Islam, conservative Islam, institutionalized Islam that it seems to me by your question that you believe is actually motivating these violent acts. On the contrary, these are, whatever else you want to think about them, they are radical reformers. They are radical individualists. They are taking upon themselves the power of the institutions to define this faith. And they are doing so in somewhat unique but also very violent ways. I hope that makes sense in some way.
Last question. Thank you.
I'm a Mormon that lives in California. There's a mosque about 3 miles from my house. I've visited it many times. I've prayed with them. I've attended their Ramadan dinners when they break their fast. We're putting together something now between my congregation and the mosque group so that each side can learn more about each other. And we're trying to turn the five pillars of Islam into language the Mormons would understand: prayer, faith, fasting, pilgrimage, good works. Pilgrimage, we're calling maybe missionary work or something. We haven't figured that one out yet. I've got two questions for you. Our leaders, the Mormon leaders, our first presidency, made a statement some years ago that said, in essence, Muhammad was inspired by God to help bring millions to God. So now, the two questions. I think we could say God is God and Muhammad was his prophet. That raises the question, are we partly Muslim? And with your broad connections, do you see these kind of bridge building efforts happening throughout the country?
Thank you. Thank you for that. It's a great way to end our time together. I truly believe that the answer to religious violence is religious peace, that the answer to religious misogyny is religious feminism, that the answer to religious bigotry is religious pluralism. I reject this notion that the problems with religion can be fixed by getting rid of religion. Because, first of all, it's ignorant. And secondly, because it fails to understand that religion is about the interpretations of the individuals, the communities who experience that religion. So if you are a misogynist person, you will read your scripture in a misogynist light. If you are a feminist, you will read the exact same scriptures, but in a feminist light. I often have to remind people that in this country's history, not 250 years ago, both slave owners and abolitionists not only used the same Bible to argue their viewpoints, they used the exact same verses. That's the power of scripture. Its interpretation, its power, it rests in the hands of the individual who encounters it. And so if we are going to have the kind of peaceful, pluralistic, faithful community and country that we all want to have, we have to rely on communities of faith to reach out to each other, to find common ground, to figure out ways to communicate each other's values. I think of religion as little more than a language made up of symbols and metaphors to help us express what is mentally inexpressible, which is faith. But if that's true, then what we really need to do is figure out each other's language. If you know, a woman, a French guy and a Spanish guy were in a room with each other, the only way that they could truly communicate with each other is by learning each other's language. And yet, we live in the single most diverse religious country on earth, a country in which every religion and every variety of that religion has a foothold. And yet, we don't spend enough time learning about each other's religion. And when we do, this is I think what's important about what you were expressing, what we find is that regardless of what language we use to express our emotions, our hopes and fears and aspirations, the hopes and the fears and the aspirations are the same, that we are struggling through the same thing, that we believe the same thing, that we share the same value. We just use different symbols, different metaphors to express those things. And I think the true challenge, particularly for progressive people of faith, is to get past that point where we confuse the metaphor for the thing itself, that we recognize that the way that we express our spirituality through Muslim terms or Mormon terms or Jewish terms or Buddhist terms, that the terms themselves are nothing more than that, just terms. That what is truly important is what the terms represent, the values and the ideals, and how often those values and those ideals are similar, regardless of, you know, what particular set of symbols and metaphors we are using to express them. The only way that this is going to happen, of course, is through relationships. That's the only possibility. And so I really applaud you for actually going through the process of getting to know something of an faith. I really hope that this is what we're going to do, that this is how we're going to figure out a way to live in a pluralistic, faithful environment.
Thank you so much, Reza, for being with us. We really appreciate your time. We'd love to have you back anytime you'd love to come. So thank you again.
Thanks, everyone. Yeah. Have a great time. See you soon.
So this is a pretty neat session, because we have two pretty big authors here tonight, and we wanted to be able to have a space and a forum that hosted two heavy hitters that are doing amazing things with their writing and with their words, and really just helping us to learn and to grow. So we're so excited that we were able to bring them together tonight here at this space at Sunstone. So our next speaker, again, another renowned author, Judith Freeman, is an American novelist who frequently deals with Western and Mormon themes. She is the author of many books, including Red Water and her latest memoir, Latter Days. We're going to have Judith come up. She's going to speak to us for about 25, 30 minutes, and we will have the rest of the time for questions. So, please.
Well, thank you all for coming tonight. It was really wonderful to listen to Reza Aslan. I also live in Los Angeles, and we have mutual friends, and he is such an extraordinary person to speak to these issues. The title of my talk tonight was Memories of a Mormon Girlhood. I'm going to wander around a little bit with that, but I first want to thank Lindsay Park for inviting me to come here and be a part of this conference. This is not a conference that could have happened in the 1950s, when I was growing up, or the 1960s. And I'm so struck by the quality of inclusiveness and by the variety in the various sessions today and by the expansiveness of thought that's represented. The thing that would link maybe the two talks, not terribly closely, but one thing that I've thought about is the way in which the origin myths of Islam and Mormon Mormonism have a certain connection. Both Muhammad and Joseph Smith received visions from angels that appeared to them in wilderness settings, Muhammad in a cave, Joseph Smith in a wooded setting. Both men, when they received those revelations, created new religions and also texts to go with those religions, new books, the Quran and the Book of Mormon. Both men were polygamous and visionaries and charismatic figures, and both men were persecuted and their followers for their beliefs. But he connected in a much more essential way that really has to do with the idea of identity. I really hadn't planned on writing a memoir. Most of my books have been fiction. The last book was a biography of a writer, Raymond Chandler. Mostly I've converted my experience growing up in Ogden, Utah, in a family of 8 children, with very religious parents, with ancestors that go back 6 generations, with ancestors who knew Joseph Smith, who were part of the original group who stayed through the persecutions and the difficulties and who made the exodus to the West. So this is a very deeply rooted religion that I grew up with in a very religious family. I'm going to talk very briefly about how it was that I came to write this memoir, because it was rather serendipitous. It was 4 years ago. It was the Republican convention. Mitt Romney was running for president, and many of my friends were saying, who is this person? Where does he come from, and what does he believe? And he wasn't talking so much about his religion. And I was asked to write an essay for the Los Angeles Review of Books, and I had a lot of trouble finding the right tone, finding a way to write about what Mitt Romney wasn't really saying about his religion and about my own experience growing up in a Mormon, big Mormon family. And I eventually came across a piece of information that Mitt Romney's great-grandfather, Miles Park Romney, and my great-grandfather, William Jordan Flake, knew each other. That Miles Romney was a patriarch in St. John's, and my great-grandfather was a patriarch in a town called Snowflake, named after him and Erastus Snow. And they were both arrested for polygamy in the 1880s. And the bail to get out of jail was $1,000 each. And Miles Park Romney did not have the money, and my great-grandfather borrowed the money, the $2,000, so they could get out of jail. While they were awaiting trial, only Miles Romney never went to trial. He went to Mexico with his wives and his family and became part of a polygamous colony there. My great-grandfather was tried in Prescott and was sentenced to 6 months in the Yuma Territorial Prison, where he served out of his sentence, a friend of the governor's, helped establish reforms in that prison that was really significant, went back to Snowflake and his wives and his children and became one of the first state senators. The point was that Miles Romney never repaid my grandfather that $1,000. And so my essay in 4 parts for the Los Angeles Review of Books began, Mitt Romney owes me money. You're laughing, and that was my attitude. It was a kind of ironic and light way of getting into this subject of who is Mitt Romney. The essay went on to talk a little bit about Romney and his beliefs, and then it talked about the way that I was raised in the church. It talked about my novel, Red Water, which was published in 2002. Which is about the Mountain Meadows Massacre, but really it's about the three of the 19 wives of John D. Lee. The story is told through the women, and the story is really about the consequences for one family of that great tragedy. But Again, it was published almost exactly 4 years ago on the eve of the Republican convention. And the blowback from that was quite extraordinary. The Los Angeles Review of Books got more mail than they've ever gotten about anything that they've ever published. And I could tell that it was from a group of similar people because they all misspelled the same word in some of their letters. But for me, it was startling and upsetting. I'm not a person who, I'm a little thin-skinned. And I was receiving emails like, get a job. Stop trying to get money out of Mitt Romney. And obviously it was a slight lack of a humor about, but what came out of that essay was understanding that I had found a certain tone and a certain attitude and a certain way of looking at my own history and a voice, an ability to speak about it with a certain kind of freedom and with a kind of wryness. And also, I think, with a great generosity toward the people that I come from. And it hasn't always been easy for me. I was called to an excommunication hearing after Red Water was published. I didn't go. The letter that summoned me simply said, we understand you're a writer of some repute, but we also know that you've been making certain statements and have written this book, and we would like to call you to a hearing so that you can explain your religious views so that we can decide what should be done about them. This was not a proposition that I could accept. And so the idea of writing a memoir that would deal with a history, a personal history that was loaded both with richness, with a great richness of ancestors, history. You know, Wallace Stegner, who had such fondness for Mormons, he came here when he was 12 years old, after being drug around the country by a ne'er-do-well bootlegging father, and he lived here until he was 22. And among the Mormons, he found his people. It wasn't that he wanted to become part of the faith, but he understood that he had landed among a people with history, and he had no history. And he really valued that history. And I think it's what so many of us really value, in part, about our own relationship to the church, whether we continue to maintain a strong, active relationship with the church, strong, active faith, or whether we choose another path of questioning, what is that identity? That history was very important to me. My memoir, when I started writing it, I knew it would be about the first 22 years of my life. Those were the important formative years. And I think when I talked to Lindsay Park and when I talked to Joanna Brooks and when I talked to certain young, strong, feminist Mormons, I understand that there was a way to have a relationship that really wasn't possible for a girl in the 1950s. We didn't have that possibility of seeing a certain kind of strength in women. We saw our mothers as strong, but we also understood that it was the priesthood that really had the power. And I always pushed against that. I always pushed against the idea of patriarchy. I wanted to believe in some way that I could be the equal of boys, and that as a woman that I would grow up to be the equal of men. It's interesting that now I realize there is more diversity and more wondrous complexity in the composition of you people in the audience, of the people who are here at this convention, the range of thinking. It astounds me. It makes me very proud. And it makes me think that Reza Aslan is right, that the way that we expand our community is to really ask questions. And from the time I was a child, I was asking questions. And I also at some point felt, how can you believe in something when you have never had the opportunity not to believe? And as a child, I never had that opportunity. But I must say, I also had the most fantastic childhood. And I think many of you in this room would say that was the case for you too. It was so much fun. That sense of community, that great spirit of activity, the baseball games, the plays, the music, the dances, the fact that you knew who you were and you knew where you belonged was a great gift. I remember the turning point. One of the turning points for me as a child was I was a great lover of horses in the outdoors. I was a tomboy. I would much prefer to be on my horse on a Sunday, riding out in the foothills, than reading the funny papers and going to church and waiting for the big meal to be put on the table. And I, for a long time, as a 10, 11-year-old girl, would go out on Sunday after church and ride my horse. But my father was the first counselor in the bishopric, and he came to me one day and he said, I really hate to have to do this, but I have to ask you to stop riding your horse on Sunday because I'm getting complaints from the other people in the ward. Their children are seeing you riding. And they say, well, why can't we do the same thing? And we know that the Sabbath is a day of rest. And so I have to ask you to stop riding your horse on Sunday. And then he added the thing that was really significant. He said, if it were up to me, I would say, go ahead and do it. But it's not up to me. And at that moment, this slight little chink opened up in the armor. This slight permission to go ahead and question it. I felt that what he was saying to me on some level was, I don't really believe that either. And with that moment, he allowed me to begin questioning even more. Do I believe in this? Do I think this is a good idea? Do I think we all should sit around on Sunday? Or would it actually be okay to go out and ride your horse? I think one thing that happens for many of us raised as Mormons, and some of you are my age, some of you are much younger, very few older, but I think that we, you know, that we're looking for a way to make sense of our experience. And my childhood up until the age of 12 or 13 was quite idyllic. It was quite remarkable. I loved the people who surrounded me. They were magnificent, wonderful people. And it was a lovely childhood being raised in that large family. But something happens when you begin to enter puberty, especially as a girl. But I think it's true for boys, too. Sexuality is a really dangerous, kind of threatening, complex thing. And when you begin to move into your womanhood or your manhood and you become a sexual being, you begin to change. And also, I think the way that you are treated is changes. There has to be slightly more control. It's, for me, one of the strongest experiences of writing a memoir was to actually look at the whole idea of memory. I came to believe that memory is an enormous, extraordinary, exquisite myth-making machine. And that is something that was born out in Mary McCarthy's Memories of a Catholic Girlhood. She wrote that book in 1957 by writing a chapter And then going to her brothers or sisters or uncles and saying, did things really happen this way? Am I remembering it correctly? And they would say, oh, no, 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 that didn't happen that way. It happened this way. She'd say, oh. There was a lot of variation, people present at the same events and what they remembered. And then she would write another chapter and she would go and say, did things really happen this way? What I came to believe is that these are kind of fables of factuality, as Irving Howe once said, that we create stories about ourselves and our past and how we were raised and who we are to really fit how we want to think about ourselves as we evolve through our lives. And those memories evolve too. And many of our memories are really fables of factuality. They're myths. But what I came to feel wasn't a myth was that for each of us, something happens and we get a feeling. Something happens when we're 7, when we're 9, when we're 10, when we're even 5. And it is such a powerful feeling that that becomes the imprint. That begins the process of making memory. But around that feeling, all kinds of things are woven. Who was there? Who said what? What happened? Those can become very fictional. But what I came to believe isn't false is the feeling. That's the one thing we can trust. That's how we build memory. Something happens. It's one thing to remember events in your past. It's another thing to have a written record and to be able to look at a journal or a diary or something that you wrote or something that your teacher wrote about you and to say, well, here's some evidence. Here's some written evidence of something that I said or something that I did. For me, one of those pieces, because I did not keep a journal, I grew up in a house where we really didn't have books, except books of a religious nature, answers to gospel questions, you know, those kinds of books that didn't really appeal to a child. I never had a library card. I don't remember reading fairy tales or being read to as a child. There wasn't a lot of written material, but what I did come across was that what my parents saved a notebook from my seminary class when I was 16 years old. And it's a turquoise notebook, and it has the angel Moroni in gold on the front. And it's a loose leaf, and it's stuffed absolutely full of papers, of handouts and worksheets and essays. Things that I wrote in that seminary class to please Brother Gallup, my teacher. Now, I've already said that from the time I was 12, I developed a very questioning mind, and I became something of a rebel and a little bit of a wild girl. And yet, when I looked at that turquoise notebook, which came to me after my parents died in the 90s, but I never really wanted to look at it. It always gave me a slightly queasy feeling, like, what would I find in those pages if I opened it and started looking at it? What I did find when I decided to write this memoir was a girl I didn't even recognize. I was incredibly surprised because I had fashioned this memory of myself as being quite rebellious, quite a, you know, if not wild, at least someone who was constantly questioning, constantly pushing the boundaries, constantly asking, does this make sense to me? Do I believe this? Do I want to do this? Not really. But what I found in that notebook was a girl who, as I said, I hardly recognized. It was a girl who was writing essays, for instance, about an outing to Bear Lake, when I dove off a raft and there was a motorboat above my head, and the motor was cutting, the blades were cutting close to my head, and I was underneath the raft and I was trying to get up away from that boat. And I said to Brother Gallup, and I offered up a prayer. And when I offered up the prayer, I found the way up. But I knew that wasn't true. I knew that what I had written was to please the external person. And I had become rather adept at doing that. I don't know whether any of you experienced the same, had any of the same experiences. But for me, I began to develop a schism between the girl who wanted to question, who wanted to develop her own identity, and who was working very hard to do that, and yet within the culture knew that the way to get by, the way to pass, was to be able to reconfigure this story into this story that would certainly get an A on a paper. I found things in that turquoise notebook that astonished me. Take a personality test. Are you always this, sometimes this, sometimes this? When I looked at the way I had represented myself, the only thing that I had said that I always was depressed. And I don't know that I even could understand what that word might have meant then. But I think what it revealed to me was a girl who was struggling mightily to try and figure out how to bring together these two halves of a person, a 15-year-old girl, that in her own sense of identity, with whatever intellectual capacity I had, and the questioning mind that I think I was developing, was going this way in a culture that was hurting me very strongly in this direction. And how could I bring those two girls together? One of the things that I found in the turquoise notebook, aside from extraordinary teachings that were coming from J. Edgar Hoover, from Ezra Taft Benson, in other words, there was a political element to how we were viewing ourselves too, as an exceptional people. But the most important part of that seminary class had to do with dating and marriage. And I realized that at 15 I was being really prepared to become a mother and a wife. And I felt within my family it was never going to be a possibility for me to be sent to college. Neither of my parents went to college. They were remarkably intelligent, interesting people. But education was not going to be part of my future. Not for my brothers, not for my six brothers, not for my one sister, and not for me. The idea was that when you finished high school, you either went on a mission, or you got married, or you made your way in the world. You made your living. You earned it. And I didn't really know girls who were going to college. They weren't in my circle. And I began to think that the way that I could get out into the world was through marriage. And at the age of 17, the day after I graduated from high school, I got married. And the idea was that my husband, who was 6 years older and who had graduated from BYU with a degree in psychology, and just incidentally had been my sister's boyfriend before he was mine, that we would go in the Peace Corps and that that would be our future. And I was thrilled at the idea that I was going to go out into the world with this new husband, and we were going to make an extraordinary life together. We were going to go into the Peace Corps. We were going to help poor, suffering people. But instead, I got pregnant within a couple of months. And by the time I was 18, I had a child. And that child was born here in Salt Lake at the Cottonwood Hospital with a major congenital heart problem, a transposition of the great arteries. Those children had just died until maybe a year before my son was born, and then there was an operation that was invented. And so, at the age of 3 weeks, at the LDS hospital, he was operated on, a palliative surgery, hopefully that would help him gain enough weight that he could have the kind of open-heart surgery that he needed. He had to weigh 30 pounds in order to do that. And he was so small and so blue and so sickly that to gain weight was so difficult. And he spent most of the first 6 months of his life in the primary children's hospital. And I would think of how when I was a child and the music would play in primary and I with the penny march music and I would march up and give my pennies. And now my son was in that hospital that I had given my pennies to. It was a very difficult first few years of my life, and I won't talk about it, of his life, of our life together, but something remarkable happened. When we took him to Minnesota when he was 2.5 for his major surgery, my husband, who by then had gotten a master's degree and was now going to get a doctorate in psychology at the University of Minnesota, we took our son Todd back there for surgery. And the surgery was successful, but there were complications. But at that time, John, my husband, got a job on the campus of McAllister College. And what an extraordinary place, an extraordinary liberal arts university or college. And this was in 1967. And I left Utah and stepped out into the world at the most remarkable moment, in the middle of the Vietnam War, the summer of free love, the civil rights marches that were going on, Martin Luther King. It was like coming out into the world at an extraordinary moment, but John got a job on the campus of McAllister College as a counselor, and I could take classes for free. And for this first time in my life, I took a class in literature taught by a remarkable man named Roger Blakeley. He used to sit at the front of the class with a cigarette in his mouth, with the smoke sort of curling up in front of his eyes. And when he found out I was from Utah, he said, "Ah, those Mormons." As though he understood something that I didn't. But what Roger Blakeley did was that he introduced me at the age of 19 to literature, to Thomas Hardy, to Henry James, to Virginia Woolf, to Willa Cather, to D.H. Lawrence. And I thought, who knew? What an extraordinary world of literature. And in those books, I began to see my future. And I said to myself, this is what I want to do. I want to be a writer. And it seemed like such an audacious idea. I mean, what was I thinking? This young, untutored woman from Utah. What made me think I could become a writer? What made me think I had stories to tell? To the first, I really didn't have an answer. I don't know what made me think I could do it. But I did believe that I had stories to tell. And that the way that I would learn how to tell those stories would be to read the great writers. That if I could study, if I could keep reading, if I could emulate, that was the way that I could figure out how to become a writer. The next summer, I took a writing workshop from Mr. Blakeley. And I wrote my first short story. And it was set in Utah. And it was called County Road D. And at the end of that workshop, the class voted. There was going to be a little prize given to the best story. And that story won. And I walked out of the class that day with a completely outsized sense of happiness. And I, who had felt that I could not keep up with these extremely smart students who had had wonderful educations, who had come from families where the houses were loaded with books, I suddenly thought, I do have stories to tell, and I think I can do this. So by the time I was 21, I was divorced. Not surprisingly, teenage marriages often really don't work out that well. And I moved back to Ogden, Utah, with my four-year-old son, and I moved back in with my parents, who generously took me back in spite of my waywardness. And I lived with them for a while I tried to figure out what I wanted to do. But the point that I want to say, and maybe now coming to the end of what I want to say, is that it is this culture, and it is this background, and it is my ancestors, and it is the extraordinary richness of my upbringing that has given me the material that I've needed to have the writing life that I've had. And that girl who left McAllister College with a son who had survived two surgeries and now was going to be okay, could really now begin to think of herself. It would be almost 19 years before I would publish my first book. I was almost 40 when I published a collection of short stories in 1988. And the stories were called Family Attractions. And so many of those stories recount growing up in Ogden, Utah, in a Mormon community. And I remember when Jerry Howard, the editor at Viking Press, he bought those stories. He was the third editor to see those dozen stories that I'd written. And he asked my agent, who was brand new to me, does she have a novel? And I had tried to write a novel. It wasn't very good. And I'd put it away in a drawer, and I thought, I'm just going to write stories until I can figure out point of view and voice, how to set a scene, how to create structure, how to move a story. So I began writing short stories. But there was this novel that was in the drawer. So when the agent said, you know, if you have a novel, they might want to make a two-book deal. Do you have a novel? And I thought of this not very good novel that had been sitting in a drawer for a few years. I said, well, let me take a look. And I took that book out and looked at it. It really wasn't very good, but the first chapter was. And it was a character named Verna, first person voice. And it was as though that character, Verna, who was really my doppelganger, had been waiting in that drawer for 3 or 4 years for me to mature and be able to really tell her story. And I threw all of that book away except the first chapter. And I wrote 40 pages very quickly and gave it to my agent, and I made a two-book deal. So that The Chinchilla Farm, which was that book and that first novel, came out in 1989. And I've never looked back. And I have much to be grateful for. This book has only been out for about 7 weeks. And the reviews have been very interesting. And almost universally, one of the things that all of the reviews have said was that there's absolutely no rancor. There's no feeling of settling scores. There's no feeling of judgment. And I think that has to do with the great gratitude I feel for where I came from. Even though I'm not active in the church and have not been for a very long time, and I live in Los Angeles, I live in a community of writers and artists. There is affiliation and there's filiation. And filiation is who we are and where we come from, who our family is, who our connection is. That's one family we have. And the other is affiliation. Who do we affiliate with? Who do we identify with? Who is our other community? Mine, artists and writers, intellectuals, gay people, feminists. I feel a great comfort with that community I've created. And it's absolutely wonderful to be here at this conference and feel the deep inclusiveness of both communities. And I thank the organizers and Lindsay Park for that. And thanks to Misha, too, for the introduction. Thank you. And please feel free not to ask questions. It's late. It's been a long day, but if anyone has any burning questions, I'm happy to answer. Please.
Judith, thank you very much for the wonderful presentation. Did Romney ever send you a check?
No. He didn't. I wonder if he even knows that he owes me money, but... some people even calculated the interest on $1,000 in the 1880s, and it's considerable. And I think with the wealth of the Romneys, they could kick in, actually.
I was curious if you think that this reconciliation you feel that you found is more a function of age than anything else, just because I remember as I was growing up writing about my past Mormonism, it was more a function of years that helped take some of the rancor out of my writing.
That's a good question. I don't really think I could have written this book at 30 or 40 or 50. But what's remarkable about what's happening right now in the writing world is that memoir has almost overtaken the novel as the genre of our time. And we have people who are 25 writing memoirs, and then 30 writing another memoir, 35. So there's no end to the idea of how interesting we can find ourselves. How much we'd love to talk about ourselves and our particular lives. And really, the truth is, almost every life is so rich that if you had the capacity to write it, it would be interesting. It's the nuance, and it's how we struggle, and it's how our emotional and psychological feeling. I do not think I could have written this book before this time. And it's interesting. Is the word reconciliation, is it... I was talking to Michael Quinn this morning. We're staying at the same house, and I also must thank Holly Alden for giving us just such gracious hospitality. I've completely forgotten what I was going to say about. Yeah, but what were we talking about? I'm sorry. Michael, you're brilliant. He had just read or is reading Angle of Repose, and he asked me about Angle of Repose, and I'd just been thinking about Stegner. And one of the great quotes in that book is when the narrator is thinking about the marriage of his grandparents, which had his great difficulties, but they stayed together. And he says something like how two unlikely particles clung together, rolling downhill until they reached that angle of repose. And when I realized that's where the title came from, and then the narrator goes on to say, that's where the interest will be if I find it. That's where the real interest is. It's how unlikely particles can adhere and can move through time and difficulties and tests, and then finally come to this angle of repose. And I actually think that's what we're all looking for. We're looking for that angle of repose. We're looking at for that moment where the strife and the tension and the difficulties, the unresolved feelings about our own histories. What do we call ourselves? How do we feel? How do we identify? Who are we? How do we help our relationships endure the dissonance of our personalities? How do we maintain friendships and love? When we can finally come to the point where we feel a kind of peace, a sense of repose, that's a very important thing. And I think it helps to have done some living, so to speak. And when you reach a certain age, if you can find that angle of repose. And I certainly think writing The Latter Days has brought me into a much more peaceful place. For that, I'm very grateful. Thank you all. Thank you so much. If anyone would like a book, they're outside. Thank you so much.
Boy, do I have some surprises for you. First of all, I want to thank all of you for coming tonight. As Judith mentioned, it's been a long but amazing day here at Sunstone. And to be totally candid, there were times when we as a staff were discussing whether or not a Thursday plenary session would be appropriate. You know, is it okay to maybe take one of the nights off? And we had all sort of agreed that way, and Lindsay said, well, wait a minute, I've got this idea. And that idea came to fruition tonight in so, so many ways, with Judith here, with Reza here. And I just want to thank you all for being here, making the extra effort to stay a little longer today to partake of this feast that we've had. And thank Lindsay for coming up with this idea that we all supported, but we were all a little nervous about until she told us who was going to be here. So thank you for that. I had the good fortune of sitting back there with Kurt Bench, and he just reminded me to remind you that we have books by both authors available that are going to be out in the foyer. They will be, some of which are on sale, and we'd like to encourage you and invite you to please partake of these wonderful writings that have been prepared and presented in many ways to us tonight. And Judith, if you could join me up here, I have a little somethings for you. First of all, we have this commemorative sunstone for you, which we hope you will display prominently somewhere around your neck.
I saw this earlier, and I really wanted one. Wow, well, thank you.
And this kind of goes along with some of the things you were sharing with us, but in addition to many Mormonisms, we came up with a little slogan to share this season as well. More than one way to Mormon.
And, would like you to
thank you so much.
And lastly, you're staying with Holly. So that in and of itself is a marvelous, marvelous treat.
Yes.
But Holly is a board member who has really gone the extra mile in supporting Sunstone this year. You saw him for the first time last night if you were here. You saw him at the front desk. You'll see them everywhere in a few more hours. But these are official Sunstone Skull Candy headphones.
Wow. Thank you so much.
And if you would just wear these for the rest of the night.
Jeez. Now I can hear nothing but myself, my own voice. Wow.